there might be changes to the way condo associations operate. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A Florida Bar task force has presented a series of proposals on how to make condo living better and safer. It comes in the wake of the Surfside condo tragedy. But some of the proposals are big and controversial. Will condo owners go for it? Also, we meet the man who was central to passing Amendment 4 and Florida felons getting their voting rights back. He just won a genius grant.
I kind of equate it to winning the Super Bowl and being named like the Super Bowl MVP.
Finally, we'll talk about a new short film getting buzz at film festivals. Gringa is a movie made by a Miamian about the Cuban-American experience in Miami. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, shortly after the collapse of the Champlain Towers Southside, the Florida Bar put together a task force to look at condo laws. A little more than a week ago, that task force published a report with proposals for changes to condo laws to improve safety. Now, some of these changes are likely going to be controversial, but these proposals now go before lawmakers who are preparing for the upcoming legislative session in January. Joining me now is Bill Sklar. He's chair of the Life Safety Advisory Task Force. He's also a professor at UM School of Law, teaching condominium law now for more than 40 years. Bill, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Luis. Pleasure to be with you.
Remind us when this task force was formed and how.
Sure. Within days of the horrific tragedy at Surfside, the Champlain Towers South building collapse, the Florida Bar requested that we form a task force not to investigate the causes or causation of the tragedy, that would be beyond our areas of competence, but to look into the laws and regulations governing condominiums and suggest changes in the laws and regulations to either mitigate or prevent such a tragedy from occurring again. We quickly formed a task force, including myself as chair, of eight board-certified condominium and plan development lawyers, each having as much as 30 or 40 plus years experience. Some represent condominium associations. Some of us represent developers and lenders. And we undertook a series of 19 meetings, seven of which had presentations by numerous experts, building officials, structural engineers, resiliency engineers, Florida Association of Realtors, and many others who we sought input from, insurance experts also, relative to the issues involved. And so, one fact I'll point out for you, which is very important here to keep in mind, of the 1.5 million condominium units, residential units in the state of Florida, over 912,000 of them are over 30 years of age. That's 60% of the units in Florida.
So we have
having
a lot
residents over 30 that are 30 years of age that are residential.
So we have a lot of old condominiums then throughout the state. You know, briefly, I wanted to ask you, Bill, is, you know, the other thing too, what do people get wrong about how condos and condo associations are governed and where those laws are set?
Excellent question. Unlike the studio you're broadcasting from, the office building I'm in, residential market rental apartments, office buildings, et cetera, condominiums do not have professional governance. And what I mean by that, I'm not suggesting that most are not well-run or well-managed, but in the cases I mentioned in commercial real estate, there are lenders, investors, private equity, and each of those require a maintenance protocol, inspections when they're financed or sold. In residential condominiums, there is no standard for maintenance. There is no maintenance protocol. There is no inspection requirement. And we focused on that. And indeed, what we are calling for are very robust duties and requirements for maintenance protocols, for life safety, and for inspections, and not waiting 40 years for recertification.
All right.
And if you want, I can get into more detail.
Yeah, well, let's look at some of the key points that you brought up in this proposal. And again, I think these are the ones that are going to be very controversial. But let's take a look at, for example, one of them is giving association boards the right to make special assessments for major repairs to protect resident safety without a full association vote. So am I getting this right? Basically, you're saying if there's a need for inspection or for repairs, that the association can just go ahead and do it without a vote?
Correct. It would be a vote of the board, not a vote of the unit owners. The problem is, because of the human nature of trying to save money and be popular with their neighbors, boards are often under the pressure not to spend money, kicking the can down the road. So to sum it up, I call it TRIM: transparency, reserves, inspection, and maintenance. So to the extent there's anything in condo documents that says you need a 50 or 66% vote to have a special assessment for repairs or to spend money, we call for that to come out of the documents, to be void. Why? Because we cannot have the lack of maintenance, the lack of deferred maintenance. We're calling for duties upon boards to be transparent, to provide inspections, to be proactive. We cannot leave to chance that there are almost 2.5 million people in those 912,000 units, and we don't know whether they're being well maintained or inspected.
And the other thing,
yes, go ahead.
The other thing too, though, that we got from the Surfside is, look, different counties, different municipalities have their own rules on how often these things need to be checked, how often there needs to be, you know, even basic maintenance inspections. So what about that?
Well, there are no standards for maintenance inspections. The only recertification requirements we found, as you're probably aware, are in Miami-Dade and Broward.
Right.
And that's a 40-year recertification. I'm glad that exists. But in many forums I participated with building officials, such as the building official for Miami-Dade, for Miami Beach, and they were very candid, very transparent. They said unless an engineer presents in writing a report saying there is an imminent life safety threat, they will not send out an inspector. And when they send an inspector, it is a drive-by inspection and not necessarily and not usually by an engineer. We're calling for inspections to begin within 5 years of an association being turned over and by a certified structural engineer or architect based upon 13 items in the statute at the time of turnover, including electrical, plumbing, structural, pool, elevators, etc. And that, yes, that will cost some money. It costs several thousand dollars to do such inspections, but it will establish a baseline. We're also calling for the statute to be amended to include a maintenance protocol, initially by developers for newer condos, since they have to give this inspection report a turnover anyway.
Right.
But even for existing condos, within the next 3 years, by the end of 2024, there must be a maintenance protocol, and that establishes that what must be done to the condo.
We're
not waiting until there's falling concrete or rebar blowouts or pools leaking into garages.
Yeah, let me just
cannot wait. Leave it to chance.
Briefly, just want to remind folks we're talking with Bill Sklar. He's the chair of the Life Safety Advisory Task Force that was created shortly after the Surfside tragedy, and they have released a report on proposals to make condos safer, which is basically changing laws. These are going to legislators up in Tallahassee, and the legislative session, by the way, starts in January. You can learn more about that report and some of their proposals on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Now, we've been hearing from listeners. One sent us in this comment. Hector says, condo associations should be regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level and audited annually with criminal penalties imposed on members of the board for fraud and piracy. You know, so many, you talk about condo associations and you open up a Pandora's box. Everybody's got a lot of thoughts on their condo associations because, Bill, as you said, there are a lot of condos in the state of Florida and so many here in South Florida. I want to look at another proposal that you posted in this report, that condos can raise fees on condo owners when needed, but help us understand what you're proposing.
Well, when I'm saying raising, it's not a question of raising fees. It's having more robust reserves for structural repairs and deferred maintenance.
Okay.
Right now, it's limited to roofing, repaving, and repainting. And we are suggesting the legislature require robust reserves for all of those 13 components of the building. Now, there's the ability to waive reserves currently. We suggest it be made more difficult by a 75% vote instead of majority. But here's the most important part. If you're going to waive or reduce these robust reserves, if you're going to kick the can down the road, there must be an alternative financing mechanism in place. And that's where the special assessments come in. But it could also be a line of credit with a bank. We talk to bankers. Bankers already lend to associations. They like them as borrowers because it's collateralized by the assessment revenue. But also, there are government subsidized programs or guaranteed programs like the PACE program used for hurricane strengthening and energy efficiency. We suggest that that program be expanded. So when a 75-year-old limited income resident is faced with a $50,000 special assessment, he or she can qualify for that program. Their assessments effectively would go up by $40 or $50 a month, or really be a mortgage payment, home equity or a first mortgage if they don't have one. And then the funds are there. So the concept of structural maintenance doesn't have to be a fear of a special assessment. So yes, we're calling for more robust reserves, more difficulty in waiving them. And to the extent you still can waive them, you must have an alternative financing program in place, lines of credit or special assessments or a government program, either local, state, or yes, even federal. We've talked to federal officials. There's the infrastructure debate in Washington. What's the difference between a roadway leading up to a building and the concrete and rebar that support that building?
All right.
That's considered infrastructure also.
For purposes of time, I wanted to get to one other big one here, and this is about condo associations and the amount of power they maintain. What is in the proposal when it comes to the associations?
Transparency. For instance, these building inspection reports, we call for them to be posted on websites within 10 days. No association, no board, no manager, no person should sit on a report out of fear that they're going to be recalled from office. There must be increased transparency and the right to bring an action if a board is not transparent. Again, most boards are well-managed, buildings well-maintained. But for those that are operating in the dark or in fear of their neighbors, that has to end. And we suggest several methodologies, increased websites, increased reporting, but that has to occur.
Have you spoken with any lawmakers or the governor about this report?
I've spoken with several lawmakers and their senior staff. So far, we're getting support for the concepts, but we have yet to see, as staff is looking at our report, and staff participated. Senior Senate and House staffers attended several of our presentations, and senior members of the Senate did also. So they are in the process, we understand, of drafting We don't expect all of these proposals to be adopted, but we do expect the concepts of a maintenance standard, inspection standard, transparency, and more robust reserves to be in a legislative proposal in this coming session.
Realistically, do you think it has a chance this year, next year?
I will certainly work towards that, and I believe if ever there was a need and an opportunity, it is now, in light of the horrific tragedy and 98 lives lost and so many families inexorably broken, now is the time. So yes, I do believe there is a chance, and I will work collaboratively with the legislature, the governor, and all their staffs to bring this to fruition.
This is a fascinating, proposal. And again, this idea of how we operate condo associations and Surfside has made us think about a lot of things. Bill Sklar, again, chair of the Life Safety Advisory Task Force, also a professor at UM School of Law, teaching condominium law now for more than 40 years. Bill, thank you so much. We'll have to have you back when that session begins. Let's see where lawmakers take some of these ideas.
Thank you, Lewis. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And you can learn more, by the way, about these proposals on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And, by the way, you can email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. We'd love to hear from you. If you live in a condo, tell us about what you think should change with the way condo associations operate, with the way condos are maintained. Let us know your thoughts. This is another program we need to have sometime in the near future. Again, that investigation in Surfside is going to take a while, but we can look at how condos are run and what could be done to make them better. Again, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, still to come, we're going to learn more about the man who led the fight to help felons in Florida get their voting rights back. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In 2018, Floridians voted to pass Amendment 4, which restores voting rights to formerly incarcerated people. Desmond Meade was once a convicted felon. He has since become a leading figure behind the passing of Amendment 4, and now he's one of the most prominent voting rights activists in the country. Desmond is the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, and he was recently named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow for 2021. WLRN's Danny Rivero spoke with Desmond to talk about the future of Amendment 4 and his activism.
Just a few weeks ago, you were named as one of the MacArthur Foundation Fellows for 2021, which is an extremely prestigious honor that speaks to all the work you've done on voting rights here in Florida. Where were you and what went through your mind when you got that news?
I remember when I was first notified by the MacArthur Foundation that I was selected as one of its 2021 geniuses. I was actually driving at the time. And, it was real funny because they called previously and I thought it was a telemarketing call. And so I didn't, pay too much attention to it. But eventually I end up answering the phone. And when they notified me that I was selected, I had to pull over on the side of the road. I couldn't continue driving because it was, it was very overwhelming. I remember when I was talking to him how I kind of equated to winning the Super Bowl and being named like the Super Bowl MVP. To hear someone on the call say that I've been selected and knowing the selection process and how it's peer informed. It was very humbling, and I was extremely honored and overwhelmed altogether.
And that honor was due to your activism in helping pass Amendment 4 in 2018, other activism you've been involved with, which has together helped an unknown thousands of Floridians with felony convictions regain their right to vote. Can you take us back to the moment where you knew that this was your calling, that this is what you wanted to do?
Daniel, I'm a spiritual person, man. And I remember years ago when I was in drug treatment, I remember being on my knees one morning and telling God that I didn't have a clue where he was going to take me. But wherever it was, I knew that, number one, I would make sure people know who got me there. right? But then number two, really be even more committed to just doing his will. And it was basically that, what can I do with my life, with all of the things that had brought me to my knees? How could I, you know, use it in such a way to uplift other people and to create a better society for all? And it was, you know, it was in those moments when I would have those intimate conversations with my higher power, that just every time just gave me even greater resolve into just making an impact in people's lives.
When you were on that campaign to pass Amendment 4 in Florida, was there a specific moment when you really felt like, yes, this is something that really does have a chance of passing? Because there were a lot of people that thought it would never happen.
I always used to say that all of the experts said that it was impossible for this to happen. Controversial topic, dealing with controversial people in a controversial state, during a controversial political climate, you know, that it was all, it had all the ingredients for failure, you know. But the time that I became encouraged, especially early on, was when I had conversations with real people, not with consultants, not with strategists or pollsters, but with real people on the ground in different communities, whether it was at a barbershop, a store, a library, in a line at the grocery store or something. And I mean, not just people who look like me, but having conversations with conservatives, with whites, with conservative Christians, with African-American clergy, and with returning citizens from all sizes and shapes, you know, and political preferences, and having the same conversation with basically the same results. That's when I knew that, you know, this, we had a great chance of being successful.
And you recently got the news yourself that your full civil rights have been restored after the governor and the cabinet denied your petition late last year. And that includes the right to sit on a jury, run for public office, and finally being able to carry a firearm to go hog hunting with your son, as your wife told Governor DeSantis you wanted to do last year. how did it feel to get that news?
Well, the only caveat to that is that I would not have the right to bear arms yet. That they did not include that, unfortunately. But everything else, as it relates to the right to run for office, serve on a jury, is included. But here's the interesting piece on this too, as well.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah. Well, here's the interesting piece. Even though Amendment 4, you know, restored the right to vote for me, back in 2018, you know, I still face obstacles as a returning citizen. For instance, I still could not, even though I graduated law school, have a law degree, I still could not practice law. You know, even though I've been able to overcome so many other things, I still couldn't buy or even rent a home in a lot of subdivisions, all because, you know, practicing law or getting a home sometimes are out of the question for people like me until we get our civil rights restored.
With this latest development with getting the right to sit on a jury, run for public office, would that impact your ability to practice law if you want to?
Yes. Now I can apply to the Florida bar, right, and sit for the bar exam. Now I can purchase a home in any subdivision now, right, without worrying about being barred because of my rights not being restored. And so this have addressed a lot of collateral consequences that was associated with my previous felony convictions.
After Amendment 4 passed, there was a Florida law that was passed that tied the right to vote to paying fines, fees, and restitution. And then there was a protracted federal lawsuit about it. And in the end, the Florida law was upheld. But through all of that, you never wavered. You kept saying very firmly that even with that law, Amendment 4 was still transformational for the state of Florida.
Of course.
Can you help expand on that a little bit?
Yes, because first of all, you know, prior to Amendment 4, you know, anyone who was convicted of a felony offense in the state of Florida lost the right to vote, lost their civil rights for the rest of their lives, right? And the only reprieve that they could have gotten at the time was through the governor. And so basically a person would have to grovel at the knees of the governor and three other politicians in order to have their civil rights restored. And we know that that's a relic of the Jim Crow era. But Amendment 4 changed that dramatically, and it tore down that Jim Crow wall and created another avenue that American citizens could take to be able to participate in elections without having to go and beg a politician for that right. All right. And so even though the Florida legislature defined completion of sentence, which now requires the payment of outstanding legal financial obligations before a person could benefit from Amendment 4, the fact remains that that's still an alternative avenue other than waiting or depending on the arbitrary decisions of a handful of politicians.
I'm speaking with Desmond Mead, the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. And we're talking about him being named as a MacArthur Foundation Fellow for 2021 and all the work on voting rights he's done here in Florida. Find out more about this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So in the run-up to the 2020 election, there was a moment when Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody announced an investigation into the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition and money they said you received from billionaire Michael Bloomberg in order to help pay people's fines and be able to vote. And the allegation was that you and Bloomberg were telling people to vote for a certain candidate in the presidential election in return for paying their fines. It was very public. They announced this on TV, cable news. But just a few months ago, the state came out and said that they found no crime was committed and that Bloomberg never even gave the money to the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. So how did that whole ordeal impact you and your organization?
Well, first of all, let's classify it correctly. I think that that whole ordeal was an example of what happens when politics come into play, right? When we passed Amendment 4, we kept politicians and politics out of our campaign. And because of that, we was able to bring people together from all walks of life and all political persuasions to do the right thing, right? To rally around a basic human right issue. All right. However, you know, this Bloomberg situation, all it did was create even more confusion on the ground. It hampered our ability to raise money to help people who are too poor to pay these fines and fees, have that obstacle removed so they wouldn't be forced to choose between putting food on their table or voting, right? And it really slowed our ability to operate in our fullest, into the fullest extent of ourselves, because we were busy trying to defend a falsehood. And, you know, before that happened, everything was beautiful. Things were moving. We were helping people out. People were regaining their lives. People were able to get their driver's license back because some of these fines and fees were also attached to the suspension of their licenses. And so they were able now to pursue their dreams of owning businesses and being able to get better paying jobs.
Yeah, you consistently stress that you don't like politics, but in your line of work, politics always seems to find a way in.
They always find a way in, but that don't mean we can't stop pushing them back out, right?
Earlier this year, Florida passed a law that makes information about a voter's felony convictions public when it used to be protected. Your group came out against it, saying it could lead to voter intimidation from people who maybe don't want to see people with felony convictions voting. Is that voter intimidation possibility still a concern for you?
Yes, it is. It is a concern. And another reason why we are concerned about that is that what we've seen even during the lawsuit surrounding Senate Bill 7066 was that even within the state, there is a lot of confusion as to what exactly an individual owe or if they owe anything at all. Right. And that's been one of the mainstays in conversations around the fines and fees about how can we create a system that can accurately let somebody know what they owe, if they owe anything. Right. And then when they pay it off, give them assurance that nothing else is going to pop up. And so we're not there yet. The state is not there yet. They're still trying to figure it out. And so we're concerned that people will make accusations that a certain returning citizen who the registered voter should not be voting because they have outstanding fines and fees. And that person's analysis of that could be totally erroneous, you know? And so we're very concerned that people, your lay people, may try to get involved and try to disqualify returning citizens without having that type of background, which would falsely prevent someone from being able to participate in the into the democratic process. And we want to try to minimize that from happening.
And I know we're on an off year for elections, but have there been instances where this has actually come up, or is this still just a potential thing that could happen at this point?
It's a potential thing that could happen. We have not received any reports of that. You know, we maintain a 24-hour hotline for returning citizens that if they encounter any kind of challenges around their ability or their right to vote, that they contact us immediately. And so far, we have not been contacted by anyone that have experienced that.
So going back, you were just named as a MacArthur Foundation Fellow for 2021, the so-called Genius Grant, which is a huge honor. And it also comes with questions about how will you use that status to keep doing what you do? So what do you have cooking in the next year or so, you and the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition? What's coming up?
Well, you know, one of the things that we are continuing to do is to create all we can to create a more inclusive democracy. You know, I think on a much grander scale, you know, we realize just like a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, our society can only be as great as those who are most weakened. And so we believe that in order to create a more robust, safer a society, right, that we must remove these obstacles or these barriers that have been put in place to weaken groups of people, right? Whether it's access to democracy, whether it's access to fully participating in our economy, or whether it's shifting a narrative, right, that basically says that some lives are less valuable than others, right? And so on a more holistic front, we're looking to really bring this country together and create a better democracy, a better community for everyone. And we believe if we continue to focus on the group that have been most marginalized, which are people who've been justice impacted, that we'll be able to attain that goal.
And I know it's the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, but have you given any thought to expanding potentially outside of Florida?
Well, listen, here's the deal. While the organization has not expanded outside the state of Florida, the movement has. You know, one of the pleasant surprises about passing Amendment 4 was to see the domino effect that it had in multiple states throughout the country. Seeing the governor in Iowa restoring voting rights without the requirement of paying legal financial obligations. Seeing the governor in Kentucky restoring voting rights. You're seeing voting rights efforts being led by people just like me in California, Louisiana, North Carolina, where in all of those states, voting rights have been expanded to people even while they're on parole or probation, right? And so the impact of the work that we've done in Florida is spreading throughout the country, and the movement is gaining momentum, right? And we're seeing slowly but surely the expansion of democracy, especially to people who have been impacted by our criminal justice system.
And again, that was WLRN's Danny Rivero speaking with voting rights activist Desmond Mead. You can find Danny's full story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And you heard about a 24-hour hotline for those who might be having trouble with the voting process. That number is 877-MY-VOTE-0. That's a zero at the end. Again, 877-MY-VOTE and the number zero. Well, still to come, a Miamian tells us about her short film Gringa, a dramedy about a Cuban-American woman packing for a family trip to Havana. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so have you ever packed for a trip at the last minute? Well, that's how the movie Gringa begins. A Cuban-American woman is rushing home to pack for a family trip to Havana. But her grandfather has other plans. He's already hijacked all of the family suitcases and filled them with medicine and clothes for those on the island. And the flight, though it leaves in a few hours, her grandfather has a mission for her that must take precedence over packing any cute outfits, like finding a car part to take to Cuba. Joining us now is the director and co-writer of the film Gringa, Claudia Murray. Claudia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know what? I love this film. Because it reminded me of the generational differences that I had with my abuelo, my late abuelo. But let's talk about this story. First, it starts with the mission is to find an ignition coil for a car. And this isn't just any car part, right?
Right, right. This is a part for a car that is called Lada. It's a brand of car that they make in Russia and they drive in Cuba and nobody really drives them here. But we thought of this plot point when I realized that there are whole stores in, you know, Hialeah and surrounding areas in South Florida that sell only Lada parts for cars that don't drive here because people buy them here and send them back to Cuba for their family members.
All right. So here's a little clip from the film. And again, they need this car part. But, you know, not for her, it's more important to buy a suitcase for this trip. And then, of course, her grandmother tells her, forget the suitcase. She can just take her stuff in a garbage bag. And this is the reply.
I am not traveling with a garbage bag like a hobo because their car needs a part. One of my hundreds of cousins will be going to Cuba in the next few weeks. Let them take it.
En unas cuantas semanas. Tú no sabes que ella depende de ese carro para pasear turistas por dólares.
So, she borrows a neighbor's car.
¿Qué? No. El carro de ella es el carro del...
It's the car of the barrio. She's sitting there talking about how let her cousin, you know, borrow somebody's car, use the neighborhood car, and it turns out, well, that is the neighborhood car. It's a really fascinating story because we're looking at what life is like for a Cuban American here in the United States, but also what it's like for Cubans back on the island, right? That's you wanted to show the difference.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk about my experience because I realized when I moved to LA that not a lot of people really understood the Cuban American experience at all. And so I didn't want to tell the story, you know, the radical story of my grandfather being imprisoned and almost executed by the Castro regime, because that's kind of like everyone's story around here. But I wanted to tell that story from my perspective, from how I interacted with it, which is it's always present, it's always in the background and intergenerationally important that, you know, our families went through this, but we have our own experience of that. And that's what I wanted to show.
And one of the fascinating things I thought about is that you added humor to it. You have this dark past, as you said, that a lot of Cuban Americans have, but you added this twist of a little bit of humor into that. How?
Well, I actually started in the entertainment industry in comedy. That's I am by trade a lawyer, a constitutional lawyer. And I decided to go into the film industry because I wanted to be bringing light into people's lives and do it through comedy. So I wanted to show here that I think it's very it's a testament to the Cuban American kind of spirit, too, and like the culture where everything's funny, even when it's dark. We've had a dark past as a people, but we're still some of the funniest people around. And so it was really important to me and to my co-writer and producer, Lana Link, to make this about comedy because that's where our interests are, our origins are, and where we want how we view the world and how we want the other people in the world to view it too.
And again, as I said, the film is titled Gringa. The main character is a Cuban American, but she's often mistaken by other Latinos for being a gringa, an all-American. Are these experiences that you've had?
Oh, absolutely. Super personal experiences. And also the lead actor, Ana Cecilia, also is half Cuban. So I'm half Cuban and half Alabaman. And I actually look whiter and sound whiter than almost both, you know, both sides of my family. I'm the only one who doesn't tan across all families. But yeah, so I definitely have had these experiences growing up in South Florida. I didn't even really think I was that Cuban until I left South Florida. Because here I was always gringa. I was always, you know, the one who was kind of viewed in that way. And I've since learned since making this film that a lot of other people had the same experience. And it's really fun to show people kind of a surprising side of who you are.
The other characters in the film, are they based on people in your real life?
Oh, certainly. I mean, especially the abuelo. And it's awesome that he reminds a lot of people of their own abuelos. As we've been touring with this film at festivals, I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, oh my gosh, that's just like my Cuban grandfather. But I've also had people from all sorts of, you know, ethnicities and cultures and everything come up to me and say the same thing. So although a lot of these people are based on real people and sort of experiences that I've had, they also tend to be pretty universal, we found.
I think what's interesting, what you said a moment ago, is that you didn't think about your Cubanness, I guess, until you left.
Yeah.
But that was, you know what, I think about like, you know, we did the story recently about, I mean, the politics here in Miami and, you know, how they fired the police chief. Even though he's Cuban American, you know, they said, well, you're not Miami Cuban. I wondered if you felt that when you left Miami and, you know, like, did you then understand your Cubanness differently?
Very much so. So I had always heard tell, you know, of the vague sort of New Jersey Cubans that existed. And there's like a whole community up there. I didn't realize there were LA Cubans and also, I mean, everywhere. Chicago has a whole contingent. And we all sort of have mixed our culture with the culture that we've entered. In Miami, we had a little bit of a blank canvas, I think, coming here in the 60s. But it certainly contextualized my Cubanness, to be sure. I am a Miami Cuban. I come from here. I grew up here, and had sort of somewhat different interests sometimes. But leaving here, I realized that I still, you know, I'm having the experience of doing Noche Buena and just having the bilingual experience that we have in this place it creates a very different kind of person. And I'm really proud to be from here and really excited to show people outside of Miami how a Miami Cuban is and who we are, you know?
And did you have those same kind of arguments with your abuelo? Because like in the film, you have your lead character and she's so caught up in her life that she doesn't realize what he's trying to do is to help people back home. Did you understand, you know, the challenges back home for other family?
Certainly. You know, I think that that is actually one of the fairest criticisms I've gotten on this film is that it doesn't quite capture how much it's already ingrained in us. Like, she's too old to have found this out at the time that she did. So when we went to Cuba, we certainly, you know, packed, as we call them, gusanos full of supplies to take to Cuba. And having been there, it was very obvious to me the poverty and the difficulty that exists down there. And so growing up in this environment, it was very present. I don't think I ever had arguments like that with my family because it was always sort of like it was something that was always kind of there. And I don't want to say hanging over your head, but it was definitely present, the struggle that your family is going through back there and how much you can do here to help. So it less made me grumpy about not being able to do things and more grateful for all that we had growing up here.
I'm talking with Claudia Murray. She's the director and co-writer of the short film Gringa. It's about a Cuban-American woman rushing home to get ready for a trip to Havana, but her abuelo, her grandfather, has other plans. He takes her on a mission to collect medicine, but also specifically a Russian car part that he's got to get back to the islands. They're very important. By the way, you can find a link to watch the film for free. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. A really fun watch. I highly recommend it. By the way, I just have to ask, Vicks Vapor Rub, is that an important? That's an important medicine in Cuba, right?
Super. Absolutely. You can hear anything.
I won't say anything else. I want people to see the movie, to see that part. I just had to ask you that. But you co-wrote this piece with writer-producer Lana Link. How did the two perspectives influence this story? How much of it was more you and so forth?
Well, the beauty of Lana, who has gone on to direct many award-winning films, has gone on to produce many award-winning films, is that she was always there for the story. And so she was my friend and I worked with her at a production company. She was my boss at the time. I was working as a producer. And this film was born out of a conversation that we had about it. And her mind she's very sharply comedy minded and very structure minded. So as we were writing, it was a lot of me kind of going off in lots of directions and her bringing us back to what is the story. And it helped make it really universal. I think a lot of things for me wouldn't have felt universal if I didn't have someone who was outside the culture telling me, oh no, that's something that I went through in this way, or I had that relationship kind of, you know, play out in this way. And so I love collaborative writing, and I especially love it with Lana Link. For me, it was a magical experience, and it was both of our first films. So, we've gone on to collaborate since then, but it was definitely something, it added a lot to the writing of the film to have someone who was outside the culture kind of guiding me on what was weird and what wasn't.
At the end of the film, you have a note with a special thanks to families, grandparents, great-grandparents who left everything to come to America. What do you wish more people understood about the immigrant experience?
Wow. I could fill volumes with things I wish people understood more about the immigrant experience. So one is that it's like kind of universal in a way. So we said that pretty generically on purpose because, you know, Lana has Lebanese heritage too. And, you know, have had basically everyone who lives in this country, almost all people who live in this country have had someone come from somewhere and really fight to get here. I do some documentary work about immigration also. And I guess the main thing is I wish people understood how difficult it actually is. People don't just waltz into this country and live a grand life. It is an extremely difficult thing to leave behind everything you have. And people have reasons for doing that. And so, yeah, I hope that people can sort of open their eyes a little bit to the immigrant experience. I've had folks telling me that it was curious to them to see how much of the old world is integrated into your life here. And that's a huge part of it too. You know, we're children of immigrants have sort of two worlds they're walking between. And it's great because it makes us more objective, but it's also something that we, you know, it's a layer that we have that other people don't. And just like anything else, listening is the most important thing.
It is a lovely story. And then it got me thinking, you didn't even study film.
No.
You went in a totally different direction in your life.
I really did. I was a lawyer at first. I actually sued the city of Hialeah in a kind of high profile case here a few years ago on behalf of the street vendors of Hialeah. And then I went on to do political speech writing. I did that for a year. And from there, I went on to do comedy. So it's definitely been a weird path. And I kind of fell into filmmaking with this film because we found a story we really wanted to tell. Lana and I are both writers and we did it. We wrote it. And when we were done with it, I said, you know, for the same reasons we wrote it, I think I should direct it because nobody else is going to understand how to make this real, how to detail this to the point where it's believable. And to their credit, the Moving Picture Institute said yes, gave us a budget and made me a filmmaker. I didn't mean to do that. But it is my absolute calling and it is what I was meant to do. And I'm so happy to be doing it.
I almost get the sense that your story is a movie. I'm sorry, lawyer, political speech writer to comedy. That's a movie in of itself. You're working on a couple of upcoming projects. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Thank you for caring. I'm finishing up a movie with the Moving Picture Institute. We shot it this summer. It's called Unloaded. It's another one of their original shorts. And then I'm also collaborating with them on a romantic comedy set in Miami. And that's still in the writing stage, but that's what we're doing next.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, from watching this film, I'm sure you would have been great at law, probably good at speech writing, but you know something, great to see that you're doing this. Again, the movie Gringa, it's a short film, fascinating story, and I think a lot of us can relate. As I said, it really did make me think of my late abuelo and the kind of arguments that we always had with each other, but they were loving at the end. Claudia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Luis. And just a little reminder that abuelos can watch it too because it's bilingual. So
absolutely, anybody. You know what? Great point. Absolutely, it's bilingual. It does have subtitles too, so people can enjoy it. Claudia Murray, again, director and co-writer of the short film Gringa. You can watch it for free. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, October 25th. By the way, some of the music for the film by Balo, which is, of course, the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band. Balo, that is creates the music for this show, and you can find them online, gobalo.com. Well, that's the program again, as I said, for this Monday, October 25th. Leslie Ovais, our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Amber Amortigi is helping out with production. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director, and WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Coming up tomorrow on the show, there's been an alarming decrease in routine childhood vaccinations during this pandemic, and experts are worried about what this is going to mean for measles, polio, and others that we thought we had eradicated. Also, there's an agricultural revolution happening in Puerto Rico. Farmers are looking at more sustainable options and reducing their dependence on chemicals. We're going to be doing a lot about Puerto Rico this week, by the way. And a new documentary looking at the complex history of Florida's waters and beaches. The filmmaker joins us to talk about Black Floridians' fight for the right to swim. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.